1888 Podcast Network.
I'm John Barrett Ingalls, and this is The How, The Why. Presented by 1888. Every week, we connect with artists, authors, and innovators in the world of publishing and literature to discuss their creative process and creative purpose, and explore the evolution of the industry. 1888 serves as a regional catalyst for the preservation, presentation, and promotion of cultural heritage and literary arts. Let's get connected. This episode was recorded live at 1888 Center by Brew Sessions Live.
This is the How the Why Live. My name is John Barrett Ingalls, and today we are connected with Peter McLaren, professor, activist, philosopher, author of multiple books, most recently, The Pedagogy of Insurrection. Peter, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
My pleasure.
Now, I want to start. In your book, you talk about that at a pretty early age, you recognize the failings of the educational system. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk a little bit about that and how you started to recognize how the system wasn't working for you or for any of us, for that matter.
Well, I remember growing up in Toronto, which is my native city, growing up in Toronto, attending elementary school. Every Canadian, well, I grew up in the 50s, right? Born in 48, grew up in the 50s and 60s mostly, my formative years. And I recall being asked what I'd like to be when I get older. And of course, as a Canadian kid, I said something probably pretty predictable. I want to be a hockey star, a hockey player. And the teacher said, oh, you want to be a hockey player, eh? And he said, maybe if you try really hard, because you don't have any skill, you might be able to get a job in the factory that makes the hockey pucks. I remember wanting to be a high school teacher. And I did an undergraduate degree in Elizabethan drama. And then I did work in fine art. I wanted to be a sculptor, and I ended up, after that, doing a master's in education and then PhD after that in educational philosophy, educational theory. But I remember wanting to be a high school teacher, but I was, you know, married at the time and had a child on the way, and it was going to take 2 years to get a certificate to be able to teach high school. And so I had enough savings to attend Toronto Teachers College for 1 year, and that allowed me to teach from kindergarten up until grade nine, you know, up until basically senior public or junior high school. And I started working in a school that was in a wealthy village, and I did okay my first year. I was teaching grade 7 and 8. I thought that I was an okay teacher. It was my first year, and I had a feeling that the students in my classes were going to succeed, not because of me, but maybe in spite of me. In other words, I felt that their socioeconomic status, well, I prefer the term, you know, their class location. As a Marxist, I prefer to use that, because if you use the term socioeconomic status, it almost naturalizes the fact that poverty is just an inevitable part of, you know, social life. I don't think it has to be an inevitable part of social life. And so I thought, I want to work with young people that that don't have that kind of advantage. And so I quit after a year, and I became a substitute teacher In Canada, we use the term supply teacher. I don't know, it's supply and demand, more capitalist sounding term, I guess. But I went to work in a school that nobody wanted to work in. First day I went in for an interview, there was a teacher banging his head on the wall. There was tissue from his forehead and blood coming down the wall. And I met a remarkable principal. His name was Jim Montgomery. He was known as the hugging principal. He was like a father figure to me. And he gave me the job. He said, "You didn't come highly recommended by your previous principal, so I think you'd be perfect for this school." And we developed an incredible bond. And he was a hugging principal because, now we're talking the 70s. He took a sledgehammer and smashed the walls of his office down with a sledgehammer so that you could have immediate access to his office. He threw out his table and chairs and substituted it with a rocking chair. And he would sit there and do his work in the rocking chair, and students would come in and he'd give them a hug. And of course, there was never any problem with that, you know, I mean, giving the students a hug. And he did that for 20 years. He became a legend. And I was fortunate enough to have him as a principal. Now, I'd say he was a sort of a classical liberal. But he liked some of the innovations that I tried. And I have no explanation for why some of them worked. For instance, my students, I think it was a grade 6 class. I'm not sure exactly, because I taught grades 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. 7 and 8 was within the rich school. So 2 to 6 was in this particular school. In a place, by the way, in Toronto, which still has a reputation for, you know, a lot of violence and et cetera, et cetera, due to all kinds of factors. And this was quite a telling experience for me being there. I decided that I would throw out all the desks and chairs from the classroom and just bring in pillows and, you know, cushions and things like that to sit down. And there was a few chairs. Brought in a piano, found an old piano. I used to go and get a truck. A friend lent me a truck, and I used to go to the rich neighborhoods on garbage night and sort of, scrounge things that I could. And I got a set of drums. And all we did in class for a month was just drum. I don't know how to play the drums, but we all just played the drums and banged around with the piano. And of course, when the students were tested, all their scores and every single subject went up. I have no idea why. I don't have a sort of theoretical explanation, but I developed a bond with the students. And I'd always wanted to be a writer. And I thought that, I came from a conservative family. You know, my dad was almost president of the Young Conservatives. He lost by one vote. My uncle, who was famous for sinking the German battleship Bismarck, for helping, he was in the ferry Swordfish, that he was a navigator that spotted the Bismarck and sent the torpedo. And so I had sort of celebrity conservatives in the family, and I respected them a great deal. But I was a product of, you know, the 60s and the counterculture. And I had, when I was 19, I'll get back to the school, but when I was 19, I hitchhiked to the U.S. in 1968 and hooked up with a man named Dr. Timothy Leary.
I've heard of him.
Yeah. And Leary gave me my first diploma. "Peter, you are now free," after ingesting some purple pills.
Sure.
It was interesting during those days because, you know, I hung around in San Francisco and L.A., went to protests at Berkeley and things like that, came back, and when I'd when I went to university, I realized that a lot of my professors were Americans. They were draft resistors. We don't call them dodgers. They were resisting the draft. And I learned a lot from, we had a sort of reverse brain drain. Usually Canadians, you know, come down and make, you know, make their livelihoods in the U.S. and become, you know, successful, presumably. But during that time, we had a lot of, you know, entrepreneurs, artists, writers, professors come from the U.S. up to Canada. So I was politically, I'd say...
Inspired?
Inspired, but still relatively inarticulate at that particular time. So and so I'm at the school, and I have some pretty radical ideas, but I don't really have the theoretical foundation to really understand what I was doing. And I stayed there and wanted to write a book about my experiences after being there for 4.5 years.
Did the school have like a curriculum pretty similar to what we would have here in the United States, like standardized testing and?
Yeah, not as much. Yeah. Not as much in those days. Teachers still had a pretty strong autonomy in terms of what they could do. We weren't sort of, you know, we didn't teach to the test. We didn't, you know, use a sort of prescripted curriculum. I mean, we had to write our behavioral objectives down every day and things like that. But things would happen. Snipers would shoot at us from the high rises, but they weren't trying to hit us with bullets. They were just trying to frighten us. Like they would blow the windows out of the back of the school. Sometimes parents would bring trained attack dogs in to attack teachers they felt were abusing their kids.
Wow.
We had things that, you know, some kids would just be living basically on salad dressing. And I wrote about it. And, you know, my principal could attest that everything I was writing about was true. I thought that writing a book about it would sort of expose, and I must say that this community was totally public housing, all the high rises, low, you know, public housing, and rent was a sliding scale. There were a lot of the fathers of the students I taught were in prison, and. We had a lot of immigrants from different countries, West Indies and other countries. And there were about, I think, 34 different languages spoken at home. And so I thought, I need to draw some attention to the needs that these students have. And so I did a draft, found a literary agent, and to my shock, the book became a number 7 bestseller in Canada. And, you know, I had HBO offers through movies and all that kind of stuff. But I think writing the book was a mistake in many ways. And here's why I believe that. My editor was wonderful in many ways. But I wanted to try to analyze my experiences. Because, as Miles Horton, the great Appalachian educator, said, you only learn from experiences that you learn from, you know. It's like, you know, we all have experiences, but just as important as those experiences are the theories we use to interpret our experiences. So if, you know, you're reading, you know, Marx, Freud, or bell hooks, or Gloria Anzaldúa, you're going to interpret your experiences, right? You're going to filter them through some of the theoretical frameworks that you've read and you're familiar with. And so I didn't have much of that. I read had read Jonathan Kozel. I was told that I was kind of like, somebody called me the Canadian Kozel. I wouldn't want to ever say I was could write like Jonathan Kozel, but that's what they kind of nicknamed me. And I hadn't heard of Kozel, and when I went and read his books, and Jonathan Kozel, for those listeners who aren't familiar with him, is one of the great writers about school and education. He wrote books like Savage Inequalities and many other famous books. Very important. Not as left, perhaps, as I am, but I think his work is very, very important. And so I focused on the more sensational aspects, some humorous things, some things like, I'd say, Freddie, this was in my book, Cries from the Corridor, and, Freddie, I can't recall the name, but Freddie came into school, he showed me some cigarette burns he had on his arm after his stepfather tied him, to a bed and burned his arms, or something like that, something more equivalent to that. I can't recall exactly. And then I had some humorous experiences, but mostly I focused on, the violence. And so the reviews started coming out, and they'd have pictures of, sometimes there'd be like a cartoon accompanying the reviews in the newspapers, and it was like, how could this, teacher survive in the jungle with these sort of, animals? That kind of sentiment, blaming the victim.
Sure.
And I'd think, oh my goodness.
It's not what you were going for, yeah.
That's not what I was going, that wasn't my intention. It was like, it was like, they called me Canada's White Shadow after a TV show that ran, I guess, I don't know, in the 70s, 80s, something like that. And it was about a white basketball coach who worked with African-American high school kids and was their coach, and he was called the White Shadow. And it was, a more serious version than Welcome Back, Kotter. Sure. And these are all... So I got a little nervous. And then I decided to take a leave of absence from my school, and I decide that I'm going to do my PhD, and I'm going to really learn, And I did. I took a lot of courses, and took one course with Michel Foucault and famous scholars that were visiting from different countries, and I wanted to learn because I felt that I was relatively inarticulate politically.
What did you get the PhD in?
In education.
Okay.
Yeah, in educational theory. So I get into the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education, which is the number one education school in Canada, and I'm feeling pretty good about myself. I've got a best-selling book. My picture's on the cover of magazines, and I'm feeling a little bit self-inflated. And I'm driving to my class thinking, hey, not bad. I'm 30 years old. This is 40 years ago. I'm 30 years old. And I've written a best-selling book. I got into the best PhD program in the country. I think I can do some great things. And then as I was driving, I was listening to a radio show. And I think it was CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, which broadcasts from coast to coast. And they were interviewing, or the moderator was interviewing a white supremacist. We got them in Canada, just like we got them here. Maybe not as bad, not with the history of violence that we have here around that. But I was thinking, why are they wasting time interviewing this white supremacist? They could be interviewing me. that's kind of where I was, And the problem with getting success early in your life. And so I was just arriving into the parking lot of the university to attend my PhD class, and the host said, well, I don't agree with your opinion. You know, the radio host said to the white supremacist, I don't agree with you, but thank you for sharing your views, and we're going to wrap it up. And then the white supremacist said, hold on a second. Can you give me just a few more seconds? He said, okay, you've got 10 seconds. I want to recommend a book to all Canadians. What book is that? Peter McLaren's book, Cries from the Corridor. And I almost went through the front windshield. I stopped my car so quickly.
Jeez.
And I was trembling. And the host said something like, well, what would make you recommend that book? I'm aware of that book. And it would seem like Peter McLaren would have the opposite viewpoint that you had. And he said, well, that might be true. But when you look at all these dark-skinned students behaving like animals in our classroom, you want to change the immigration laws and keep them out. Then I realized I did something wrong. And the Toronto School Board, or the North York School Board, North York is now, it wasn't a city then, it's separate cities, I think it's the fourth largest city in Canada right now, said to me, or said in a newspaper interview, I read it, that when McLaren comes back, we're not going to let him teach in an inner city school, we're going to put him out into the you know, we'll put him out somewhere to a rural area where he can't make his controversial statements, etc. And then the school board had a conference, and they were organizing a conference with the Social Planning Council. And I got a call from somebody on the committee, and they didn't know that this person knew me, you know, and said, Peter, don't go. I said, why not? Well, you're going to be asked to speak in front of the community at North York Woods Library. It holds about 500 people. And you're going to be booed, and you're going to be asked to leave, and, you know, and then the school board's going to say, look at all the wonderful things we're doing in the area. But I went anyway, and I was also told that there would be a group with baseball bats that were going to break my legs. And that never happened. There was no attempt to hurt me or harm me. But I remember going and speaking and explaining why I wrote the book. And a member of the West Indian community, a woman came up, a parent, and as I was in mid-sentence, reached for the microphone and I handed it to her. And she said, Peter, you know, we loved you as a teacher. You loved our students. They loved you. You came and had lunch with us. You had dinner with us. You visited some of our fathers in prison. And you spent so much time with our students. We know that you lived about an hour away, and you would stay till sometimes 7 o'clock playing floor hockey with the kids. And we love you for that. So why did you write this book and demonize our community? And I never forget that. And so I decided that I was going to become very theoretically grounded. And when I was in my PhD program, I read as much as I could. I attended classes again with these visiting scholars that I was actually reading in my PhD course. And I got stronger and stronger and stronger. And I decided I'm going to spend time in a school, and I'm going to do it right this time. And so I was banned, however, from any of the schools in North York. And I was officially banned, and so my thesis advisor said, you're Catholic, Peter, right? And I said, well, yeah, I converted recently, but I've never been to Catholic school. He said, well, I think I can get you in a Catholic school, because they were part of the separate school board. They were called the separate school board at the time. So I got into a Catholic school, and I wrote a book using a lot of the theoretical frameworks and ideas that I had, you know, acquired throughout my 4 years of studying for my PhD. And it got published. I got a telegram from Routledge in England saying, Don't take your manuscript, don't take your PhD to anywhere else. We want to publish it. And then I couldn't get a job in Canada because of the controversy over my book. And I got invited to come to the United States to interview at Miami of Ohio by my friend Henry Giroux. And Henry is very famous, cultural critic. He writes, you know, I think they did a special, he did an interview with him in Village Voice recently. No, Village Voice, what? Rolling Stone, sorry. I'm going back. I'm back. I just had an acid
flashback.
Rolling Stone. And Henry had been fired at Boston University, and they tried to fire a historian called Howard Zinn at the same time. Zinn had tenure. They froze his salary, I think. Henry was not granted tenure by John Silber, who was running for governor. He didn't get it, fortunately. He ran on a racist platform, and he had designs on running for the presidency, and he got rid of Henry. Henry.
They were fired because of what they were teaching?
Because of what they were teaching.
Okay.
And so Henry introduced me to a Brazilian educator named Paulo Freire. And Freire is actually now the patron of education in Brazil. And Paulo had been teaching students, students. He called them educants. Paulo was working with peasants, with campesinos in Recife, Brazil. And through Paulo's approach to pedagogy, the peasants were starting to ask questions like, hey, you know what? Maybe I'm not poor because God wanted me to be poor, or maybe it's not just luck that I'm poor. And they started asking critical questions, and Paulo became famous for his approach, which became known here in North America as critical pedagogy. And they put Paulo in prison. And after 70 days, they let him out, but they knew he would be killed. And so he went into self-exile. He went to Chile, where Pinochet, who was a dictator who was put in place by the U.S., as is the case in terms of U.S. foreign policy in so many instances. And Pinochet called him, you know, a communist, and he had to flee, and he went to work with the World Council of Churches, and then eventually he taught at Harvard for a while. He went back after 17 years to Brazil as a national hero, and Paulo became my mentor.
Is that where you first were inspired by the concept of Marxism?
That was, well, it's interesting because my work now is more in liberation theology. I've just begun to move into that direction. I kind of hid my Catholicism for a while. Paulo was a Marxist and a Catholic and a social justice educator. And just like Jesus was, you know, you could was a socialist, or, you know, if you take a look at the biblical teachings, you'll find out that Jesus spoke more about differentiating wealth than he did almost anything else. Mm. You can't have someone rich and have someone poor.
Sure.
That you can't build the kingdom of heaven when there's inequality. And that's, you know, you could just, it's all throughout the scriptures.
The camel through the eye of
the needle. The camel through the eye of the needle, all kinds of things. So there's a compatibility between Marxism and Catholicism. Now, I'm not a supporter of, you know, the failed experiments of communism, the Eastern Bloc police states, the totalitarian, you know, states, because they were never communists. They were always state capitalist. They were state capitalist. They weren't anything like anything like communism was articulated in the writings of Karl Marx. Marx would be turning over in his grave if he saw the results what people did with his work. But there is a compatibility. And Paulo was a figure I admired greatly. There's actually a statue of Paulo at Chapman University, right beside Benito Juarez.
Okay.
And across from Martin Luther King. But I became more interested in Marx because I was caught up in this wave of postmodern thinking, postmodernism. You know, that went along with, and I was mentioning earlier, the CIA would fund abstract expressionism in the arts, right? Because it was interpretive. They didn't want sort of a truth, like in the social realism, how the Soviet Union, you know, they would have, you know, or even during the Cultural Revolution in China, they'd have great art, right? The fist smashing the capitalist banker. So it was safer to be, you know, to sort of have your art not easy to explain and understand. But actually, I called myself a critical postmodernist. And then after, a few years after the, I think it was March to June or something, 1991, the fall of the Soviet Union. Well, a few years after that, or the following year, I was in Halle, East Germany, and I was trying to support East German professors who were being replaced by West German professors after the fall of the Soviet Union. And I met some British professors who had been critics of my work. They said, we think your work's amazing, but, you know, but Marxism is a better explanatory framework for things you're writing about, like racism, et cetera, and different things. Marx is a really good explanatory framework, and you really should, I think, reconsider some of your positions. And I decided it was time to re-engage with Marx. And so I discovered the work of a woman called Raya Dunayevskaya. Raya, as a young woman from Ukraine, was fleeing Stalin, the Stalinist regime, and went to serve for a year as a Russian language secretary of Leon Trotsky. Trotsky, of course, as we know, was assassinated in Coyoacan, Mexico, and by Stalinists, right? And Trotsky was there at the invitation of Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera. Raya was there for a year because Raya, at that time, was a great admirer of Trotsky. Then Raya had a big disagreement with Trotsky over the Hitler-Stalin Pact and whether or not the Soviet Union was a degenerated worker state or not. And she, rumor had it that she actually lost the ability to speak for 2 or 3 days because she went up against her idol. Imagine a young woman going up against your idol who's so world famous. And she went to the U.S. She went to Chicago, Detroit, places like that, and taught Marx and Hegel to factory workers. Now, I had just picked up a book of hers from the library because it looked interesting. And then I get a call from the secretary of Raya, a man named Peter Hudis, who said, I noticed that you were using Raya's work in your book on Che Guevara. And I got to know Peter. And Peter, I think, is probably one of the best interpreters of Marx in the country, maybe one of the best in the English-speaking world. And I've learned a great deal from Peter. So I still see myself as a student of Marx. And then another incredible moment came when I decided to take down a book from my library shelf by José Porfirio Miranda, who was a Mexican theologian, mathematician, philosopher, And he had written books like Communism in the Bible, Marx in the Bible, all kinds of, you know, he was a Jesuit, I'm not sure. And he wrote some brilliant work on the Bible and on Marx. And I had purchased these books in 1980 and not take them down from my shelf.
Sat on the shelf, yeah.
There were like five of his books around. And a few years ago, I just pulled one down and I thought, he's just brought together the two most important dimensions of my life, really, you know, the Marxist critique of capitalism and social justice teachings, Catholic social justice teaching. And so his work became a basis of me rethinking a lot of my work and how to make it relevant for teachers. We're in a world now where we've got these voucher schools, and we've got charter schools, and then we've got voucher private schools. And in the voucher private schools, you can put down religious perspectives. And you know, if you read a lot of these works that are coming out of Bob Jones University, and several different other publishers who teach that Satan, you know, created socialism and political correctness.
Right.
And you read a lot of these alt-right folks who blame everything that's going wrong in the country on what they call cultural Marxism. And some of them have actually gone and read the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory. They've read Marcuse, who was Angela Davis's professor in San Diego. They've read Adorno, Horkheimer, Benjamin, all these great, wonderful intellectuals who were Jewish and who decamped from Germany and spent time until the war was over in the U.S. Marcuse stayed and taught in San Diego and wrote incredible work on the culture industry, on the media. They were trying to ascertain what relevance Marx and Freud might have for the current day. And yet the alt-right is reading them in a such a way as to blame this group of Jewish intellectuals, right, for destroying the country. And it's everywhere. I've been looking at some of these authors in some of their positions. And they're white nationalists, right, neo-Nazi folks that are trying to create a white ethno-state. And they're going after this cultural Marxism, and it's basically anything it's very much opposed to social justice teaching. As a matter of fact, they think the word social justice is a concept that's been sort of voiced by the Antichrist. So part of my mission is to make available some Catholic social justice teachings to educators.
Right.
And I guess that's what I do. I'll find conflicts that are occurring in the political arena, and I'll say, how can I make this relevant for teachers and educators? And there are consequences. I mean, when I was at UCLA for 20 years, I taught at UCLA. I've been about four or five years at Chapman. Before that, I taught at Miami of Ohio. So I've been around a lot. I've been teaching for being a professor about 30 years. But in 2006, I decided that I would go and work with Hugo Chavez as part of the Bolivarian Revolution. I just thought Chavez was doing amazing things. I still hold Hugo Chavez in very high regard. And I had a chance to meet with him at Miraflores Palace, and I was given an opportunity to work as part of the revolution through curriculum reform and building new schools and universities. And that was around 2005, 2006, 2007, during the Bush administration, Bush boy.
Sure, yeah, W.
Yeah, W. And there was a group of, I don't know if it was much of a group, but I know these individuals were backed with money, and they offered to pay students at UCLA $100 to secretly audio tape my lectures and $50 to produce lecture notes. And not just me, but 29 other professors. But they put me at the top of the list. They called us the Dirty 30. It was out in, it was in the LA Times. It became an international story of are the McCarthy, years back in the U.S. And then things kind of blew over after that. But the only person to defend me, the only people that would defend me basically were the Chavistas. In Venezuela.
I would love to ask, especially with where we are now in Venezuela,
yep.
Where do you see things went awry? Because clearly something shifted.
Yep.
And I don't know if it was near the end of Chavez's life or...
Well, it was from the... There were problems from the beginning. 95% of the internal wealth generated in Venezuela now is through oil. Chavez made a mistake, I think, in not investing in manufacturing and agriculture. So basically, he relied on the oil wealth, assuming that the oil would stay at around $100
right.
a barrel. When the oil fell, the things he was doing with social programs are unbelievable. He was trying to fight corruption, which is everywhere in Venezuela, by cutting out the middleman. He created all these, misiones, these missions, right? These Mission Robinson, Mission Mercado, and the poor loved Chavez. I was on a couple of his TV shows with Ernesto Cardenal. Actually, he was on one of them, and he was the cultural minister for the Sandinistas. He's one of the great poets, one of the world's great poets, and he was chastised by Pope John Paul I, and of course, he was hated by Ronald Reagan because those were the two individuals that were trying to destroy liberation theology, and he was a Catholic priest, Ernesto. But Ernesto was on one of these shows, and he stood up, and he almost proclaimed Chavez a prophet in some ways. I've heard even the Republicans were sending operatives to Venezuela to figure out what this incredible charisma was. It was incredible. Perhaps some of it was cultish. People thought that he was a reincarnation of Simon Bolivar, but he was an honest individual who truly wanted to make changes. And he was
outside of the political and...
Yeah, he was for real, got a lot of bad press. And those mistakes came back to haunt Venezuela with Maduro mm-hmm. now, who's running things. Things are really a mess. Now to... things are just in tatters, especially when the oil went down, and you can't just suddenly become a manufacturing country. There needs to be more investment in agriculture, so it's up to the Venezuelans to make the decision of where to go next. I mean, they have the Constituent Assembly now, and the Constituent Assembly does give, you know, workers, communes, and organizations a say. But it's a little bit, as my friend Peter Hudis would say, a little bit too little too late. Mm. And to believe that the opposition will make things any better, I think is mistaken.
I'd love to bring everything back here too. I mean, talking about too little too late, it definitely feels where we are now, mm-hmm. that we are in a hole that is too deep to dig ourselves out of as Americans.
Yeah. And
what do you see with everything that you've experienced and all of the different places you've traveled? What do you see our hope is as citizens of this country?
Well, I'm not optimistic, but I'm hopeful. But the hope that I'm referring to is always conjugated with, as Cornel West would say, always has to be conjugated with struggle. I've in very much in line with Noam Chomsky's position that the doomsday clock that scientists have created, these are serious scientists that look at what's happening in terms of
climate,
ecology, and, yeah. climate, you know, politics, etc., demographics, etc. We're like just a fraction before midnight, before it's going to be too late to do much. But, you know, it's interesting. Capitalism has changed, I mean, in terms of the speed of transactions, in terms of the internet, in terms of the platforms of information now that they're creating. There's all kinds of reasons how capitalism has changed, but it still requires the augmentation of value, right? Profit. Historically, if we look to see when revolutions took place, it was when peasants were dispossessed of their land, and with the urbanization of the countryside, right, etc. And people, you know, and of course, those were the years of the industrial proletariat. We don't live in that world here like we did. So to expect the same kind of, you know, I mean, I think those conditions are still important. But we have more, well, let's take a look at things worldwide. We've got more people now that are working worldwide than ever before, but eventually, when those people get replaced through automation and start realizing that there's going to be a world with 20% employment and 80% of people scrambling, those are the conditions that are going to bring about revolution.
Sure.
But they're not necessarily going to be the same kind of revolutions that, you know, that occurred in the 19th century or even in the 20th century.
And that, I was going to ask you that. What does revolution look like for you? What does a modern revolution look like?
Well, I think that we need an alternative to capitalism. And we haven't seen that anywhere in any revolution. Like I said before, in the ex-Soviet Union and places, even Cuba, we still had the production of value, right? By that is the value I'm using as monetarized wealth, right? It was still required the production of value, profit, wage labor, etc. In so-called communist countries, if you seriously analyze them in the way that Donaevskaya did, you'll realize that they were really forms of state capitalism. People look now to, well, we look at neoliberal capitalism. That term neoliberalism, everyone is using. They've been using it for years. Neoliberal capitalism as in unregulated capitalism, right? Hyper-capitalism, crony capitalism.
Right, where we are right now.
Right, austerity capitalism.
Right.
And they think of, the answer then has to be Keynesianism. Well, we can't go back to the nanny state. We can't go back. It's just impossible when you look at how capitalism functions to go back. By the nanny state, I mean the welfare state. So Keynesianism is not an option. The option is an alternative to capitalism, and that's what we should be looking for, how to create it. And that's where I think universities should be concentrating on. There's no courses. I think people should be required to take courses in capitalism, understanding capitalism. I had a debate recently.
I even think before university. I think that should be something that starts in high school.
No, you're absolutely right. Looking at it from all different angles. For instance, I was asked to debate Vernon Smith. You can find the debate on, if you look at in the internet, Smith, McLaren, What Unites Us. And I was asked by Chapman Magazine if I would debate Professor Smith and, on economics, politics, etc. Because we're sort of polar opposites politically, that's how they cast us. And I was a little bit anxious in the debate because Vernon won the Nobel Prize in economics. And I have no training in economics. But it's a very interesting debate. And Vernon and I became friends. And we had a very civil debate. He made his points. I countered with a Marxist counter. And it was through the internet. And actually, we generated probably over 100 pages. Not all of them were published in the internet, fewer in the actual magazine, but in the internet version, at least there you can get some more substance. And Vernon, is a good man. And there should be more debates. Now, what was interesting after that is I went and saw the next Chapman magazine, and it had two students from Chapman that had differing opinions. If I can recall correctly, it was an African-American female and a white male, and they were having a dialogue. The idea was, look, we can have these discussions, and we need to have these discussions from multiple viewpoints, and we need to make decisions, and we have to make decisions relatively quickly because time is running out. And so I think that the revolution is going to come through the ecologists, and I think that language is going to be more effective than the Marxist language. If I go in and I start talking about use value and abstract value and abstract labor, and that's a vocabulary that's still important and still relevant, and I still use it, but I've been moving more towards looking at the planet and the conditions of the planet and the ecocide.
Right.
So I think I think there's three things. Ecocide, epistemicide. Now, epistemicide comes from the word epistemology, where we're losing, indigenous people and their languages and their cosmovisions, which will be very important to us in trying to understand how to live sustainably in the world. So we've got, I think it's going to be against genocide. It's going to be, and I think capitalism is a form of genocide. I mean, if you look at some of the statistics about worldwide inequality and how many people have died as a result, it's like more people have died from capitalist inequality than from the gulags and the horrible conditions in communist countries.
Well, and you talk about ecocide. I mean, I think that goes hand in hand with capitalism.
Yes.
A lot of where we are now is because of the poor practices of trying to save the buck by, shoveling your sewage into the local river building the pipelines or...
I think that you know, we should be focusing in schools and school curriculums on issues of energy, you know, maybe harnessing ocean currents. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's all kinds of ways of looking at energy, harnessing energy. We should be focusing on that and not trying to bring back the coal industry like so-called President Trump is arguing. You know, it can make you really angry, and it does. And I think the divisiveness that we're seeing now in the United States is frightening, really. But I don't think that the answer is, you know, smacking each other down. I think it's coming together and trying to engage in a fundamental dialogue. I just think of the consequences, for instance, of, you know, moving the capital of Israel to Jerusalem,
right.
and how the evangelical Christians are just loving this, and yet the Pope is cautioning for good reason. I mean, I've spent time in Israel working with Palestinians and Israelis, and this is an incredibly sensitive issue. And I just think that, I do think that the country is susceptible to forms of fascism, that it feels could never happen here because of the so-called checks and balances in the system. I really worry. I'm more worried about the conditions in the United States now than I ever have been. I came as an immigrant, 1985. You know, I get, you know, hate mail. You know, because I'm married to, my wife is Chinese, and I never imagined the country could.
But at the same time, like, the last year, for me and my perspective, I saw a rise in support for so-called socialist ideals. I saw this movement backing Bernie Sanders, and now this interest, even in our the Democratic Party, in single-payer health care.
Yes.
So it seems like there is like a little light coming through the crack.
I do agree with you. As a matter of fact, there was a recent poll, or recent statistics I came across, which show that about, and I'm not sure what the demographics were, but it was... whether it was young people, or I'm not sure what the age limits were on this poll, but about 60% of people were favoring socialism, and it was about 40% for capitalism. I think that there is a greater awareness of the limits of capitalism and the crises that necessarily accompany capitalism. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a more openness towards socialism, but then there's a great effort on the part of the right to demonize socialism,
right.
to simply say, well, didn't Adolf Hitler have the National Socialist Party? And it's sort of like that's sort of just shuts down the conversation. And so there have been efforts to demonize socialism. I don't think Americans really, I mean, they did have a vibrant socialist, you know, movement, you know, Eugene Debs and people like that. You know, the Wobblies. I was a Wobbly. I was an Industrial Workers of the World member for a while. I didn't do much, not as much as I could have, but I was a card-carrying member for a while. Obviously the young people, I think that the movements that we see young people engaged in, I mean, that might be the way that the revolution gets ushered in. I'm thinking of indigenous movements, Idle No More. I'm thinking of
Occupy.
The Occupy movements, all kinds of movements, the growth and awareness of LGBTQ populations, and the strength coming from those wonderful communities is very, very, very important. And I think that you know, the revolution probably isn't going to come the way the old revolutions came, and hopefully this time when they do come, they won't fail. When I say fail, I don't mean they failed in every single instance. I mean, women's rights were great. I'm thinking of Bulgaria in particular, were greatly expanded under communism, more so than in capitalist countries, where the kind of, fundamentalist Christian position was keeping women, right, obedient to their husbands in the kitchen. When I say these were failures, I mean they weren't absolute failures, they were relative failures. But nonetheless, not the kinds of society that I wouldn't want to live in or I would want to support, just like our society today isn't. Now, I think that eventually the conditions of not just underemployment, but unemployment, and not even in the position of ever being employed. When people get in those positions and enough people arrive in those positions, which will happen, futurists are predicting an 80-20 society, really. And who's going to look after the 80% after it just takes 20% of us to really run the world? And of course, the corporate world is saying, well, that's not our responsibility, and they're trying to pass it on to the government, and they're fighting over who's going to look after the 80% of people without jobs. Eventually, we're going to get to that position, and when we do, hopefully we won't, but people just invest so much in technology to think somehow that that's going to save us.
That's funny, because I was going to bring up, how do you see technology playing a role in these changes, in this revolution?
I think they're going to be important. I think they're going to be very important. I think the question is that, technology is a double-edged sword. And, I think we're living in a society where we're more alienated from people than we ever have been, despite the social networks that we create. We've in some way it's helped us, in many ways it's helped us, social media, etc. But social media can be controlled. I mean, it's been controlled in China. I know I'm going to be teaching there in June.
Well, we just saw how it's been manipulated here over the last year as well.
Absolutely. It can be, and there's stuff out there. There's a video out there of me doing an interview, and the interview, the sound has been replaced by Russian, someone talking in Russian, and then in the bottom in English what I'm apparently saying, and it has absolutely nothing to do. It's actually damning,
right.
It's an interview that says, somebody's asking me, apparently. So you do believe you're the greatest intellectual in the world, and you've superseded your old mentors, Paulo Freire, just things designed to embarrass you, designed to misrepresent you, all over. And I don't have a clue of how to combat those kinds of things. But it's a double-edged sword, and don't forget, 1984 was a society that had very sophisticated technology.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to sound too pessimistic. If I didn't have hope, then I would leave and stop teaching. But I'm emboldened by the young people, and by faculty and students that I've met at Chapman, for instance. I wanted to come to Chapman because of the quality of life, in a smaller town, and some pretty amazing things are happening here.
I also like to ask how you see globalization and like moving towards a potential global economy or a global culture playing in this change.
Well, I think that the work of William Robinson is work that I would advise listeners to look up. William I. Robinson, he's in sociology, and he's at UC Santa Barbara. And he talks about, and this is, it's wonderful work, and it's empirical work. You know, he just doesn't theorize about it. He's gone out and he's, you know, looked at this in a hands-on way. But he argues that we have now a transnational capitalist class, and we're heading towards a transnational capitalist state, and that crises in capitalism are inevitable. But we're part of the transnational. People now, I mean, they don't. It's like capital doesn't have, you know, a country, you know, necessarily to call it. I mean, people can still be patriotic. But, you know, just look at Bush Jr.'s grandfather, you know, helping to fund the Nazis. Mm-hmm. You had American corporations actually selling to the Nazis during the Second World War. I mean, now we've got sort of a hyper-global, you know, transnational capitalist class that thinks only of themselves. It's all about augmenting value. And we're headed towards a transnational capitalist state. Now, we have other movements which are really interesting, and I wanted to mention the Zapatistas in Mexico, right? Angie and I tried to hook up with the Zapatistas last year, but we didn't make it quite far enough into the jungle. But the Zapatistas believe that state power is always corrupting, because power over is very different than power with. So they've created autonomous communities. And this is something that's very, very important. There was a lot of debates between the Zapatistas and the Chavistas. What happened? Chavez decided to take state power. They appreciated Chavez. They appreciated Evo Morales in Bolivia. Congratulated Evo Morales for being one of the few indigenous presidents in Latin America, but decided not to attend the presidential ceremonies because they believe that taking state power is always power over, never power with. And they're about power with, they're about creating autonomous communities. And we're seeing those autonomous communities growing somewhat. In Mexico, there's a town called Chirán. And I was privileged to visit Chirán a few years ago. And they're part of the Purépecha Nation, and 500 trucks would come in a day and take out the trees and cut them down, and these were all armed by the narco cartels, and they decided to build their own auto defenses. They decided to develop their own militia,
right,
to keep them out. And they now the government has said that they're not required to vote in national elections. They still get some money from the government, from the Mexican government, but they largely control themselves. Now, there's a concept which is very popular now in places like Ecuador, Venezuela, called buen vivir, the good life. It's actually built into Ecuador's constitution. I think it might even be built into the Venezuelan constitution. And the good life means something very different than it does here. The good life basically means treating the planet with respect and graciousness. There's a term in Oaxaca. I have an institute in, when I say I have an institute, it's not my institute, but they named it Instituto McLaren. And we have branches now in Oaxaca, Chiapas, right, Michoacan, and all you know, in Morelia, in Chirán. I mentioned Chirán, which is in Michoacan, in Jalisco, all kinds of different places. And they have a term called, in Oaxaca, they've got a term called comunalidad. And it's a term that it's more than sort of It's like a reciprocal relationship of trust that isn't temporary, but it's permanent. You know, to try to, and there is cosmovisions which are articulated that we're losing. I mean, talk about losing some of the cosmovisions and some of the languages, not to mention people. My friend Sergio Quiroz Miranda, who's the director general of Instituto McLaren, told me he ran into a tribe, an indigenous group in Mexico, who told him, we are not going to reproduce anymore. We are becoming extinct, and we're making ourselves extinct because life is too cruel and too hard, wow, and we don't want our children to suffer. Just imagine a group deciding to make themselves extinct off the planet of the Earth.
It's funny, but you hear that people in this day and age say, oh, I don't even know if I want to have children. I don't know if I want to bring up children in a world like this.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I've got two children and two grandchildren, but I have members of my family that feel that way, and I can understand it, but it's sad and it's just tragic.
But it's the hope that you carry, mm-hmm, even for everything that you've studied and read and know and see. Mm-hmm. That's that hope that I think that like we all need to hold on to.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I'm out of time, and I could sit and talk to you probably for multiple hours on end. Yeah. Well, thank you, everybody, for taking the time to listen. Peter, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you.
This has been The How, The Why with John Barrett Ingalls. The show is produced by Kevin Stanek and yours truly, with production assistance by Sarah Becker. The How the Why theme music was composed and performed by Dan Record. Please consider supporting 1888 and our mission. Become an 1888 advocate by purchasing our books, participating in our programs, and pledging today. For more information, visit 1888.center. That's 1-888-Center. I want to remind you all to keep making art. Thank you.